Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Meet. My name is Mason, and on today's show, my interview with Dr. Jennifer Beavers and Dr. Thomas Yee, UTSA professors, a part of the team behind the SMT podcast. The podcast, colloquially referred to as the SMT Pod, was fostered by a graduate student who sought to create a space for scholars in the field of music theory to explain their research, studies, and present work in a manner more approachable to the digital age. Dr. Jennifer Beavers serves as one of the co-chairs for the SMT Pod, along with Megan Lyons, a PhD candidate and instructor at the University of Connecticut, as well as the creator of the SMT Pod. Dr. Thomas Yee serves on the program committee for the podcast while also lending his time as a composition chair for the SMT Pod. As discussed in this episode, there's an immediacy to podcasting, and in the case of music theory, a marriage between the new and the old. Through striving for inclusivity and diversity, the team with the SMT Podcast is paving the way in the space of music theory existing as an audio publication. In a broader sense, can you two just introduce yourselves and your positions at UTSA and also your positions with the podcast?
I'll go first. My name is Jennifer Beavers. I'm Associate Professor of Music Theory, a freshly minted professor right before COVID. So we started SMT Pod this season. So we started over the summer and our first season launched this semester, and it's going to go and through Cinco de Mayo. And I am the editor of the whole podcast. I co-chair it with a graduate student, Megan Lyons, who is up at University of Connecticut. This was sort of her brainchild, but as she is ABD and moving into the market, they needed someone to oversee sort of the bigger production, including the peer reviews that we go through. So I sort of kind of oversee it, but we share a lot of the responsibilities, and we have a really large board, including professors and graduate students across the nation. And I am super excited that I get to work with Thomas Yee in my own department. So I'll send it over to him.
All right, thank you, Jenny. So I am Thomas Yee here at UTSA. I am an assistant professor of instruction in music theory, so teaching theory, oral skills classes, and some general music classes as well. I'm also primarily a composer, so that's what I got my doctoral and graduate degrees in. And so for the purpose of the SMT Pod, I'm coming along as, I think, composition chair is what we're calling it, but basically heading up the composition area of the podcast, which is basically being a liaison with the composers that we've solicited music from to accompany the podcast. So there's like the scholars that are producing the content, and then we also have music from various composers that will fit with that content. And that's kind of what I'm coordinating.
And looking at the kind of committee, the about section committee on the website, it's kind of a broad spectrum of people from you know, different parts of the world. And what is the process of kind of putting together an episode look like? How kind of collaborative is that? Is it typically like, you know, Zoom calls here and there, or is it kind of bringing everybody together, or people kind of branching out, doing stuff on their own, and then coming back and kind of working through that as a group?
This is a huge thing because we're taking this as a premier audio publication within our Society for Music Theory. So it is kind of the main umbrella of our society, of our field, is music theory scholarship. So this is an audio publication of that. And as such, we launched it with a call for proposals like a journal would. So we launched our proposal over the summer, requesting authors, scholars, independent or university scholars to prepare their research for this medium. So we put out the call, we had a deadline, and we got about 13 submissions to us. As a board, we all read through the proposals, you know, what their research was, how solid was their methodology, and, you know, unique contributions, as well as, is it appropriate for the audio medium? And once we voted on all of those, we then met with all of the authors, explained our sort of parameters about how we conduct research. And one of the most innovative parts, before we even did any of these proposals, the board was meeting continuously over Zoom to discuss how are we going to do it, all the logistics. And one of the biggest contributions we made to the field is we have this open collaborative peer review process. So basically, it's not anonymous. When a scholar sends their work out They get to select who they want to be their peer reviewer. The peer reviewer signs their name to it. So it's a very open sort of process. It's also extremely friendly. And the collaborative nature is when we ask the peer reviewer to listen to the podcast, investigate the research, and sort of negotiate all of that, they are agreeing to sort of help the podcast along. So instead of just saying, this is false or this needs to be redone, they explain why it should be changed and how they might do it. So they actually come in almost like a second or third author. And that process has been extraordinary. After that, and I'm going to send it over to Thomas here in just a second. After that, we sort of get the peer review report back, send it back to the authors, they review it, and then they come back to us and we sort of navigate these really tricky waters of now we've got a bunch of drafts of audio and we start the production of piecing it together. We have a team of production. And so we start splicing in and cutting some of the, you know, the ums and the so's and the uhs. And we, a big part of that is that we need to have audio. So this is a huge problem in music theory, and any music podcast out there is fair use and copyright permissions. You know, we have authors that are using pop music. So, and when they throw in something like Jimi Hendrix or Radiohead, is it going to get through the bots? You know, have they covered their permissions? When we do, a lot of these mediums are using modern compositions, which may not be in the public domain. So we have to go through publishing houses and get permissions. And sometimes they want money for that. And we don't have a lot of money for that. So we do all of that, get it all together, send it around the board. And then we reach out to Thomas because he, I'll let you talk about this enormous library you've accumulated, but we bookend it and bumper it. And Thomas has, I guess, have you coded it with your magic description so that we know when we say, hey, I have this really modern sounding pod, I need some music. He just poof, gives us the most perfect transition music.
Yeah, so I can come in and speak a little bit to that. So to put this a little in context, when we put out the call for, Jenny mentioned putting out the call for episodes from music theorists, at the same time, we put out a call for compositions from composers, and I can talk more about that later. But that was to receive submissions for both the theme music for the podcast and the bumpers. And so from the theme music submissions, we selected two pieces, one to be our opening theme music and one to be our outro theme. And then the others, the bumper submissions, we put into sort of a library of files that we can then draw on to divide up segments and sort of articulate where the form of one segment of the podcast ends and then dovetails into the next one. And so it's that pool of bumpers that I'm drawing from to then find the right music to go into the episodes. Now, like Jenny mentioned, we thought about this being a podcast. Of course, there's the route that we could have gone in, like, just sought out royalty-free music or like licensing music to put in. But because this was the Society for Music Theory podcast, I think we wanted something like more in touch with the music of living composers that's being made now in the world. And so that's why we conceived of the call for scores to accumulate the pool of bumper music. So then when I'm looking at the abstract or the prompt, the subject matter for each episode, usually it's grouped by time period, but also sort of by feel and by tone. And then I look through the pool of bumper music that we have, which, like Jenny mentioned, I've commented with metadata on. So like sounds bright, you know, a funk style, electric guitar featured, things like that. And then I just go through and listen to them and see what would be the best fit for the episode. Usually nominate somewhere between 3 and 5, depending on how many bumpers are needed for the structure of the podcast. And then nominate those to the editor, and then the editor will drop them in for the final. And I think not every podcast episode has needed like extra bumper music supplied, depending on how many examples they're using within the podcast. But for the ones that we've added in bumpers for, I think it's worked out quite nicely to both be a good fit for the subject matter and just sort of support the overall tone of the podcast.
Yeah, break up all the talkiness. Some of them are extremely, you know, give an academic a mic and they go on and on like the lecture that won't end. But Thomas is also being quite modest because the amount of compositions we got from around the globe is quite impressive. It's over 100, and some of them are quite short and some of them are really long. So he's somehow coded all this. And you are really, as a composer, true blood and out for the best interest of the composer. You're always communicating when we do use their music, you make sure that they know so that they get the, they can come in and listen or note it on their CV, which is quite a heavy administrative task, I think.
And also name pronunciations. I think that's a big one for composers, because I can't tell you how many times, you know, we go off and submit our music to a call and maybe we play, so maybe they are performing our works. And then, you know, never getting in touch with us either to notify us about that or like to just ask about spelling or pronunciation of our name. And so for an audio podcast where we're going to be crediting composers orally, I thought it was of vital importance to make sure that the composers' names are pronounced as close to correctly as possible. So I usually ask the composer to record a pronunciation guide for their name so that we can credit them properly.
One of the episodes I listened to early on and then re-listened to it in the last few days was the one that analyzed the teardrop chord in the pop and film music that used in this case. This was something I was curious about is when he was talking about the films, he mentioned Star Wars and Moonlight, and I believe Love Actually was the third one. So are all of those instances when he's using the examples of, you know, Han and Leia's theme from Empire Strikes Back, or when he's talking about Nicholas Britell's music for Moonlight, are those the actual recordings from those scores, or are they kind of reworked by the composition team or by the host themselves?
Yeah, so John Baxter's the one that did that podcast, and it was super compelling and one of my favorites as well, not only because the music was super accessible and it instantly recalled those movies and those moods, the scholarship was completely sound, but he also, like a total pro, was just sitting at his keyboard and playing while he was speaking. So it came as a single track. So there was no splicing or anything. The hardest part was actually getting rid of some of his breathing or like mouth noises when he was speaking, because it was all one single file. But yeah, he was just sort of noodling on the piano as he was speaking. And so when he would mention the Star Wars, he'd be like, oh, there's that sad note that I'm talking about. And he was literally just playing the piano while he did the entire thing. So yeah, just an outstanding scholar and musician. And it was all just like effortless for him.
The podcast, it seemed to kind of stem from the Society for Music Theory, I believe, is this kind of broader organization. Can you speak to what that looks like?
So far, so it actually has its fingers branching out quite far. So some of the authors at the universities or independent scholars will solicit their own students at their university to help them with the editing. Or performances. One of the ways that we get around copyright is they solicit a live performance. They either do it themselves or they have one of their students do it. I use some of our UTSA students to help with some of the editing processes. For instance, the one I'm working on right now is this enormous podcast on Reddit in music theory, and they have four scholars from around the world, really. It's just a long interview on Zoom where they discuss all the different subreddits. And it's just such a huge podcast that I have assigned it to my students. So I have two students that are helping me do it. Maida Correa de Souza Viana is one of the students, and she's actually doing what I call a first rough draft. She's actually putting in all of the audio files into Audacity, and she's splicing it and putting in the bumper music that Thomas suggests. Another one I am using is Caitlin Norman, and she is taking the podcast and transcribing them so that we can have like closed captioning in the podcast itself. So she puts in the timestamps and does all the transcriptions. So these are super heavy, but really important tasks that take away great skills for them to develop, you know, learning how to work within a sound software editing program like Audacity, Cast, and there's another one that we're using. I can't quite remember what it is, but I'm mostly using Audacity. It's a great skill for performers and educators to use.
Audacity is nice too because it's open source. You don't have to kind of, it's not behind like a paywall. Are episodes cut in Audacity, or do you, or is it like Pro Tools even, or Adobe Audition, or what is that? What is the program?
Some are using Pro Tools. There's a new one that's out that's also, it's a paid one that one of the people is using, and I can't quite remember what it's called. Thomas, do you recall?
Was it Reaper that they're using?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Reaper.
Yeah.
Audacity is great. I find it's clunky sometimes, and you know, it shuts down, and sometimes the speaker outputs aren't great, but yeah.
Just to jump back a little bit to the when we were talking about the composition stuff, the term bumper music, can you kind of define what it represents in an episode?
Yeah, so it's basically just transitions from one segment. Like if you think about your favorite podcast, NPR is a good example for this. You know, they'll try to give a sense of the segments, like the form of the podcast, you know, sort of like act one, act two, act three. And usually they'll use transition music to help to go from one part to another. So like act one is coming to close, now act two. And that's basically, so we have the opening theme music, which starts off the whole podcast as we're giving the acknowledgments. We have our outro, which is like the last thing you hear. And then the bumpers are to sort of help us take us from like point A to point B and help to give some sense of the structure, or just like Jenny was saying earlier, break up just the constant wall of talking within the podcast.
You could tell Thomas is working on an opera because he's talking about the podcast and acts, yeah. Act one and act two.
You talk about the kind of breaking up the conversation. You know, there's, I guess, kind of different modes of podcasts. Obviously, you've got like your long form interview stuff where it's 2 hours of people just talking. Which is, you know, I enjoy some of those sometimes, but I also like things as well that are a little bit more narrative and have kind of sound design or music in there as well. Is there kind of a, do you kind of try to strive for like a balance between stuff that maybe is from in a more kind of like a critical lens and then stuff that's like more educational in an episode, or do you like to kind of mix it up or have a general theme, you know, throughout a single episode?
Yeah. I mean, when we got all of our episodes together, all of the different topics, we did try to find some structure that was going to work. We wanted some that were super general that could talk about a concept. Like for instance, one of our authors was Christopher Dole, and he talked about, is key real? You know, this notion of key in music. So it's sort of this just giant topic that can apply to a bunch of different repertoires. And then there's some that are, you know, another one that's really broad is our, we have a series by a senior scholar in the field, Joe Strauss at CUNY, and he's talking about old age and music. And so he kind of breaks it into this 5-part series, you know, general sort of lit review on ageism and how age is cultural and also biological. But he breaks each episode down into opera, how it's portrayed in opera, or how it is to be an old composer or an old performer, an old listener. So each one is branched slightly differently, and those release like monthly. So for those that are really interested in that topic, they can kind of come in, you know, once a month and listen to those. And then we have some that are, you know, very pop centric, analyzing a bridge or, you know, sonic identity. Can't, you know, what's it sound like when people imitate the sound of Bob Dylan or Jimi Hendrix? And so it's specific artists, but you could apply it to really broad things. Of course, there are the really talky conversation ones, like the Reddit, talking about that from a conversation point of view. Also, that was the bridge, was a PhD student, independent scholar talking to an expert on pop music. So it was conversational. One thing that we thought we would get a lot more of would be like pedagogical things. You know, a lot of the professors are scholars and teachers. So we thought we would hear some more about like how to teach a topic, which I think would be really accessible and wonderful for general crowds. Anyone can listen to it. And we only got one. So, and that's much later in the season, but I'm looking forward to it because that's going to bring in students and sort of education. What's the funny word? Edutainment, sort of YouTube. It was one of those mashed up words, you know, using YouTube and socials to move music theory into the mainstream.
From the perspective of like an everyday podcast listener, compared to somebody who's specialized in the field of music theory or say the topic that is at play in an episode, do you kind of hope that the podcast attracts general audiences, but also kind of caters itself towards people that are, you know, specialized in the field and kind of live on that balance a little bit?
Yeah, we really want to reduce the jargon and make it so it is accessible. It is inevitable, depending on the topic, that it's just not going to happen for some topics. You know, at some point, the level of expertise becomes, you do have to have a little bit of a working knowledge. But I hope that the ideas are, you could just take away. I love listening to podcasts, and when they speak to me as if I'm sort of inside their circle, even if it's outside of my reach, I might apply some of that to, you know, just general things and how I approach a different unrelated topic. So we do try to tell the peer reviewers and our authors, like, look for the jargon. If it gets too particular, you know, like, can you rephrase it and say it so that our undergraduate students would understand it, or, you know, a budding high school musician might listen to it, or someone who just loves pop music can listen to it and sort of follow along with it. One I'm really looking forward to is like post-millennial punk, you know, and like, that's going to have some very specific niche bands and terms for punk, right? If you aren't a punk person, will you be able to be invited into their sonic world? But yet, don't dumb it down for me. Don't water it down. I want to know what is like kosher to your culture, and what am I going to take away from it? So it's going to be specific in some way, but I think anybody could listen to it and get something from it. That's my hope. I don't know if we're successful or not.
Kind of in a broader sense, podcasting as a whole, I feel like it's kind of a budding medium. It's also something that I feel is, we're starting to kind of see maybe straying away from the kind of the interview-based talky stuff to stuff that's a little bit more narrative, or stuff in this case where it's, you know, there's parts of it that's educational and there's parts of it that's like analyzing, you know, sections of film or genres of music and stuff. Is there a hope that with this podcast in general, that it's kind of utilized by universities or like instructors to kind of like deliver instruction, or as like a means to educate, students and stuff?
Absolutely. I work like that teardrop cord. I bet Thomas, you probably could use this in your class too. I've used it for my class. The teardrop idea is this idea that you're in a major key, and these are the expectations of what the harmonies are that a composer uses. And so when that sad four chord comes in, we call that, you know, mode mixture or borrowing, and it's got a narrative to it. So the fact that he uses that in film and in pop, man, that is super relevant. It's not just how Beethoven did it or how any of these composers were studying. It's like it's approached from a compositional technique. So I definitely applied that to my classroom. And you can watch the stats go up every time somebody assigns it to a class of like 30 undergrads. You'll see the numbers sort of spike within that, you know, midnight before class sort of window that they're listening to it. So I'm definitely using it. And I worked with John on that. And I said, hey, this is super cool, but I'm going to use this for my class. Can you give us like an editable Word document that has some of your musical examples so I can tweak it for my own class? You know, not just rip it out of the podcast, but like take it into the classroom. And I'm hoping to provide more of that, you know, if it reveals itself. Thomas, have you used any?
Not at this point, but, you know, I certainly when I get back on to teaching the theory track, I would love to. Yeah, I think that has a lot of relevance. I was wondering if I could come back in on, you know, this idea of accessibility from the composition standpoint and the call for composition especially.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when we first started consuming both the podcast and the call for composition, so we knew from a pretty early time that we wanted to source our theme music and bumper music and the like from living composers. And I think this is important because when we think about the Society for Music Theory, which is, you know, the premier music theory society, I think a lot of times the associations people have with it, it's like very old composers and old music, at least from the perspective of a living composer. So like you might see sort of early 20th century composers being covered at the latest, but like a lot of Beethoven, a lot of Ravel, a lot of Chopin, and, you know, just sort of older repertoire. And so one way that a podcast from the SMT could have gone is like basically getting recordings of those older pieces or whatever pieces are being covered, and like using that as sort of like the overall audio tone and time period even of the podcast. And so I think from the production team from a very early point, we were not on that. We were not on that train. We were much more on wanting to get a snapshot of today's music and living composers today. So when we were putting out the call for compositions, I was sure to try to invite as broad a net of composers in terms of genre, in terms of age and demographic identity, in terms of nationality, and really just try to get a snapshot of everything, you know, musically that's going on right now. Whether you're a film composer, a jazz composer, a composer for recording sessions, whether you're a classical composer, because usually when these call for compositions go out, I can say as a composer myself, having submitted to quite a few, it tends to be like the highly technical, highly educated, formal, and sort of like edgy, innovative pieces that tend to get, you know, awards for those calls for compositions. And I wanted this one to have a very different feel to it. So we put out that very broad call, tried to send it to quite a few different organizations, not just like the main Society for Composers, but, you know, get it to an organization for jazz, get it to an organization for film composition. And so when we got in our submissions, we had quite a broad range of genre, from rock and jazz, funk, more pop, digital music production angles, as well as plenty of like the classical music composition side as well. So I think that's something that we set out to achieve, and I think that our the music that we have selected for the theme music and the bumper music reflects that sort of more accessible approach as well.
Yeah, Thomas, thank you for pointing that out. That is, it's something that is really at the heart of it. And I really appreciate you highlighting that, because you're right. The Society for Music Theory, it can be rather traditional. And there's definitely been a movement towards more inclusivity and diversity. But you're right. In a way, you could almost imagine an entire like elite society only using, you know, Bach and Buxtehude, or, you know, these types of standard canonical composers. So even if the topic is rather, I don't know, rather traditional in scope, sometimes Thomas will pull in something that sort of plays on that. Like it sounds like it's a Baroque composition, but it's on some kind of radical synth with some interesting like effects put on it. And it's sort of a way to like bring it back. Cause it's not to say that modern composers, living composers like Thomas aren't completely inspired by and relying on these previous composers, but it's got a facelift. It's been changed in some interesting ways. But I love it when we talk to composers, because they always keep the aesthetics and the philosophy deep at the heart of why we do it. That's why we need interdisciplinary work,
yeah,
really.
And I think also even just going back to the idea of a music theory podcast, like that is sort of the marriage of like the tradition, right? The music theory and the present, this audio, you know, digital medium. And so when we're approaching how do we make a music theory podcast, I think that that marriage of the old and new suggests itself. And so that's really what we aim to do with, not only in the subject matter of the episodes, but in the composition music as well.
That's funny too, because like right away when we got into this new medium, this podcast, one of the first ones that we had was this, two of the first episodes were really old. One was literally like old Bach and Buxtehude. And the other one was talking about old age and music. And I thought, oh no, here we are. We've got this modern thing and it's all old centric. But I thought, again, to bring back Thomas's word, marriage, right? It's this like, you know, you leap back a few centuries, you bring it right now. It's there's a time travel that is really compelling and immediate in a podcast that's not so immediate in a print journal.
Just in kind of like a general definition of what music theory is exactly, like how would you go about defining it?
Now I'm nervous. Oh, it's hard to explain. It shouldn't be. But, you know, it's funny because, you know, I have my PhD in music theory and my course is, the courses I teach at UTSA are music theory, but they're very different. You know, music theory for teaching and pedagogy and for our undergraduates is really the nuts and bolts of music, how to spell chords, how to hear different sonorities, how sort of things are, you know, how you label things like form or literal, you know, like cadences or phrases. It's very kind of local, you're zoomed in really close to the score. And our goal, of course, is to like zoom out and see works of art for all that it is. You know, things about how does a certain period of music sort of evoke the convention of that time. We might think of a genre, it's Baroque, it's classical, it's 20th or 21st century, or it's film, it's pop. So you could relate it to all sorts of things. Music theory on a much more scholastic sort of field is enormous. There's people that focus on very specific things like, you know, a medial caesura in the middle of a sonata form. Or there's people that focus on timbre. You know, how do composers orchestrate? And what is the effect? There's the psychology of those effects. How do we actually perceive music? And what are the brain processes that go along with it? There's things like aural skills that we learn. How do we acquire singing and listening abilities, and how do we implement them? So it's a huge range. And I just came from a local Texas Society for Music Theory conference that was up at UNT in Denton. And it's really a diverse sort of thing that covers everything from what we call musicology, more music history and ethnomusicology, you know, world music and world theories, to, you know, again, very specific things like this chord moves to this chord and how does it work? So I don't know if I did a good job. I'd bring in Thomas, because composition is next to, it comes out of composition. So how do you define it?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, from my take on it, you know, I'm coming at it from the standpoint of a composer, but a composer who's very much positioned myself like in between composition and theory, and sort of the traversing those boundaries back and forth. And so like, to me, music theory is just finding ways of describing and analyzing how music works. And I think it's important to note that how you go about doing that changes depending on the style, depending on the composer, even depending on the medium. So in my music theory work, I'm a scholar of video game music, as what's known as ludomusicology, a very current and relevant field within our discipline that's burgeoning more and more each year. And when you're working with doing analyses and music theory of video game music is not the same as doing music theory of Beethoven. And I think sometimes we can approach in our education, like if we teach someone how to analyze a Beethoven sonata, then like that's all they need to know to approach any kind of music. And with video game music, it's very different. There are many different concerns. And all of the medium-specific considerations going into analyzing video game music, like, is also music theory. Those things are also, even though they're not maybe applicable to like the Beethoven sonata, you know, whether you're talking about how a certain sound cue triggers relative to the gameplay, or how the sound cue enters in a certain part of the narrative, like in a cutscene, those things also are part of music theory for the video game. And so there's stuff that is very different, but there's also some stuff that's the same that you can pull over from the Beethoven sonata, and how like a pastoral topic in a Beethoven sonata might be referenced and reused and sort of reinterpreted within a video game soundtrack to, you know, score the village or give a sense of safety. And so those are ways in which I think music theory is just always this umbrella where there's stuff that's maybe more common between different mediums and different genres, and then there's a lot of stuff that's like more genre and medium specific.
This is a little bit of a personal question on that regard. Do you have a video game soundtrack that really kind of resonates with you, or one that, like, you know, stands out as a kind of a great example of executing what, you know, kind of what you're discussing?
Right. Okay. Well, this is always the tough question, because, you know, it's asking any scholar, you know, in their specialty, like, what's your favorite, you know, who's your favorite author, what's your favorite book? And so it's impossible to choose, right? There are just so many great ones. One that I would particularly nominate for doing the things that you described and that I talked about that I really enjoy is a video game soundtrack for a video game called Gris, is the French or Spanish word for gray, G-R-I-S. And so basically what I really like about that soundtrack is it sits at the perfect boundary point between gameplay and narrative. So the music is narrative, it's involved in the narrative, it's commenting on its meanings, but it's also arising out of gameplay. So it never feels like plastered on or inorganic. It feels like it's arising out of the emergent story that the player is telling. And then what's also really cool about that game in particular is that it's a representation of mental health and like a journey through grief after bereavement that I really resonate powerfully with. And the video game, the soundtrack to the video game, it brings a lot of nuance to that representation. And so I'm hoping to present on this at a future conference about the representation of mental health in video game music and looking at this soundtrack in particular.
That's so exciting, Thomas. I sent you an email. I'm sure you saw it, but we're discussing the video game. That might be the perfect. I just took down all kinds of notes. You just blew my mind. I love that.
Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah. Bereavement. I love that. Grief after bereavement. Gaming is such a therapeutic thing for so many people, a way to escape and unplug. That makes complete and total sense that you could really capitalize and create positive change for someone in that sort of state, especially as we're in this like post or still pandemic state. There's a lot of bereavement going on.
Yeah, I found a society, actually, an organization of licensed therapists that use video games in therapy and in therapy research. And of course, this video game Grease was one of the ones that they were drawing on.
We were just talking about video games in my grad class last night, and we were using, like a turn of the 20th century style that's really prevalent in so much gaming music, like generically labeled as impressionistic techniques, like the style of Debussy and Ravel. And Thomas mentioned the idea of like how composers create like the feeling of safety, or the how when you sort of leave one of the room, you go into like a sort of safe room, right? Where there's this nice, peaceful, if also slightly creepy rendition of like a well-known piece like Claire de Lune. And it adds such an interesting meaning to gaming. It really elevates so much more sonic.
Jenny, you really need to listen to this soundtrack for Grease now, because it's like Debussy all over the place. It's like Debussy plus Philip Glass, with a vocal soloist, and that's sort of what I would say the influences of that sound world are.
Hello, new rabbit hole. Thank you for that.
Podcast is inside this first season. When it kind of gets closer to the end of that, is the hope that it, can continue on in subsequent seasons, or is it something that maybe is like locked off to this one kind of?
It's expanded? Here to stay. This was our premiere season. We've all agreed to do, I don't know if Thomas is aware of this. I hope you all realize you've signed on for at least a couple of years of a commitment. We submitted to our society board that, we're going to rotate between 1, 2, and 3 years. So we're imagining this morphing off, inevitably, indefinitely. So it's here to stay. We're hoping that like as we get more people interested in it, I mean, right now we are premiering, you can see the stats. It's all over the world. And sometimes on the day it drops, we get like 400 listens right away. So that's pretty good for music theory, which is way different than a lot of other fields that get a lot of audience members. So we're hoping that it continues to go, and that we might actually get sponsors, publishing presses might sponsor us so that we can actually afford things like audio equipment and software equipment. We have... It's really hard during pandemic for everything, but we have an independent scholar in Paris. She's actually Italian, but she's doing her doctorate in linguistics and is just sequestered in a tiny apartment in Paris with no equipment. So like having microphones that we could ship out and things like that would be helpful, but we have almost no budget right now. And that's going to be problematic as copyright becomes stricter and stricter. We need money for licensing, period. So we have long-term plans.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, how many academic journals out there, going on 10, 20, 50 years of age, within their discipline, and, how many people are really poring over those journals? Libraries, of course, scholars are paying attention, but, how out there and accessible is it getting, really? And, the SMT podcast is, at its heart, a take on an academic journal, and that's why, we have the collaborative peer review, we have this drawing on the pool of scholars and scholarly topics. And so I think we could be looking at something like the future of what academic journals could look like. Or at least I certainly hope to see more from other disciplines, academic journals in video and audio podcast format, sort of in the vein of what we're doing here at the SMT Pod. And so I think that very well may, it could be the future of academic journalism. What's
up
to see?
That about wraps it up, I think, for me. Awesome. Well, I really appreciate it. Glad that I was able to kind of fit this into y'all's schedules. Thank y'all for sitting down for it. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Mason. It was good to meet you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for having interest in doing it. And I love that it might, you know, sort of parallel our audio presentation by having some audio. I love that. I mean, I'm sure you guys know this as publishers and in this sort of medium, but like the press that we get, especially in the arts department, is super helpful, not just to giving positive press, but it really goes a long way for promotion. And people like Thomas that are on junior tracks, like that are skyrocketing into fandom, this sort of public press is just, it's exceptional. It's like money in the bank.
Mm-hmm. Fun fact, I added a press section in my CV the other day. So
yeah, it really is. It's an amazing resource for us, especially as we try to branch out into more like technologically salient fields. So we greatly appreciate the interest. So thank you so much, Mason.
Absolutely, guys. Thank you.
Great
thank
to
you.
Meet you.
Likewise. I'll be sure to link everything to you guys. And
bye. Thanks, Thomas. It was great seeing you, friend. I haven't seen you in person in a long time.
Yeah, I'll see you around the building at some point.
Okay. See you. Bye.
This interview, like my previous, was also born out of a pitch for the Paisano. You can find a link to this story as well as the SMT Pod website in the show notes for the episode below. Thank you for taking the time.